Make sure you check out our online store where we work with our graphic designer to create stunning garment and product designs that feature a wide variety of aircraft types such as British fighters, World War II aircraft, American bombers, Russian fighters and much more. You can pick your favourite designs and personalise any items within our Redbubble store that range from clothing right the way through to stationery. All of our designs feature our logo so you can show your support for the channel while getting a quality product. You can head to our website aircrewinterview.tv and click store or go to redbubble.com/people/ACInterview. Thank you and enjoy. So we're back here with Tug Wilson. So can you tell us about what it's like to be a QFI and what it actually is?
Sure. The odd thing is, Mike, to start off with, when I started instructing on the Hawk, I wasn't actually a QFI. There were three different types of instructor at the TAP weapon schools. The first were QFIs, and they took students who'd never flown the Hawk before, taught them how to fly it, you know, the up, down, left, right, faster, slower stuff. Then they got into the hands of the tactics instructors, which is what I was a TI, and we taught them all of the mechanics of air combat and low level 2v1 air combat, intercepts and ground attack onto targets out in the low flying systems. And then within that they got the qualified weapons instructors, QYs, got their hands on them, and they did all the range work with live weapons, so strafing, air-to-ground bombing, air-to-air gunnery as well. So for the first half of my tour, first 18 months, all I taught was air combat and low level. It was like the best job I'd ever had in my life.
Imagine.
Yeah, and then halfway through I had to grow up, and I became a proper QFI, so I can do the faster, slower, up-down stuff as well.
So do you actually apply for this role, or are you put forward for it?
Yeah, so most people will get the opportunity, having served at the front line, of becoming an instructor. And generally it was seen as a step backwards. You know, you'd rather stay on the front line. The problem for me was I was flying the Phantom, they took it out of service. And so there was a whole heap of young pilots and navigators as well, who were looking to go Tornado F3, because that was the only other air defence aeroplane we had. But because there were so many, there were some nightmare stories of people looking at 2 years as a sim instructor on the F3 before going flying again. And that early stage of my flying career, I wanted to keep flying. So I had to kind of look around. I didn't fancy going QFIing, you know, on a Tucano or anything like that. So I thought I'd try and apply for the tactical weapons job on the Hawk, teaching brilliant stuff. My boss at the time recommended me for it, so I've got him to thank for that. And I think I kind of solved a problem in that for the Air Force, I wasn't going to be hanging around for 2 years, not really being productive. They could slot me into a place, you know, where I could hopefully do some good. You know, you never know until you start teaching whether you're going to be any good at it.
So how many pilots actually applied for this role?
I think I was a cast of one from my from my squadron. I don't know. Sometimes, Mike, I think people just get tired of the front line. It's generally older people that were applying for QFIing style posts, you know, get onto slower aeroplanes and have a bit better work-life balance. But I was still raging, you know, a little bit after the front line. So I wanted to do something that really stimulated me, and I think teaching air combat and low level was probably going to do it, and it did. It was brilliant. Yeah.
How much stick did you get from your mates on the front line?
To start off with, none, because I was flying and some of them weren't. So it ended up as a good deal. I mean, the bad part of the deal was I always knew that I was going to be posted to RAF Valley, which, you know, is at the far end of nowhere in North Wales. And people have a love-hate relationship with Valley. I've always enjoyed my time there. So I went in with my eyes open, but a few guys just thought, oh God, I'm not taking that because I'm not going back to Valley again.
So why is that polarisation of Valley there? Like, what's the big difference?
So when I went through as a student, it was a single track road across Anglesey, single carriageway road across Anglesey. So you'd drive all day to get to Anglesey, and then it was at least another 45 minutes to get to Valley. Now, it's dual carriageway all the way now, but it really polarised people because it was old Air Force, so the mess building looked like a prison. there was always bad weather there, 60-knot winds a lot of the time through winter. You know, winters are really harsh up there. And of course, we all learned how to fly the Hawk there, and it was quite an intense course. So people had bad memories of Valley. I always had good memories. Socially, it was off the charts good, because you were a captive audience. You know, people didn't go away at the weekends because it was such a drag to get anywhere. So I figured, well, let's give it another go then as an instructor and see how we go with that.
Good pubs are.
Don't know. Never made it out of the mess bar. Yeah. Always had intentions of going down to the local pubs, and then never made it.
So, what was it like actually going back to the Hawk?
It was great, actually. It was like when you start a new aeroplane. The first few months are very intense. You know, you got to learn all the technical aspects of it, and that can be a bit tedious. You know, from experience, then you need to try and get to grips with the aeroplane, and that can be tough, and each aeroplane has got its own little idiosyncrasies and they'll catch you out. But the Hawk, because I'd only flown it, I think it was 4 years previously, Mike, on my TAC weapons course as a student, so it was like putting a comfortable coat back on. You know, there's not a whole lot in it. I wasn't flying the new T2 version. It was the old T1s and T1As, which I'd flown before. And you kind of strap it onto you. It's that small. You pull it up around you like a pair of trousers and a coat. It's dead easy to start. And it is a proper up, down, left, right, faster, slower aeroplane. There's no hidden drama with it, anything like that. It's very benign, but it's really great. You know, it's fast, like a little fast jet. So I was really looking forward to getting back in it, and it didn't disappoint. And do you know what? It never went wrong. I can't think of one trip I did in 3 years as an instructor where it went wrong. So I'd been used to flying the Phantom, where stuff went wrong all the time. Stuff was falling off it as you were walking towards it. You know, it was that kind of environment. But this thing just, it was like an eager puppy that just wanted to please you, and it was brilliant.
And a question here I don't think I've asked on the channel before is, how do you start up like a Hawk, and how did it differ starting up like compared to the Phantom?
So in a Hawk, you stick the battery on. There's like a GTS, I think it's called, ground turbine start. It's like a tiny little jet engine, I suppose. You start that up, and then that turns the engine, and as the engine comes up, everything comes online. There's no selections or anything like that. Starting up a frontline aeroplane, a whole lot more involved, because there's so many more systems to bring up. There's no nav kit in the Hawk. There's no programming waypoints or anything like that. Not the Hawk that I flew. So it couldn't have been easier. That's why a lot of the time when you're a student, just starting an aeroplane up is quite hard work.
I can imagine, yeah.
So when they taxi out to the runway, and I know this from my own experience, half your brain's gone anyway just in starting up the big aeroplane. So for the Hawk, for it to be so simple, it just makes it such a brilliant training aeroplane.
And what squadron were you with when you were UFI?
So when I first got posted into the job, I went to Broadie. We had three Hawk bases in those days. We had Valley that did advanced flying training. We had Broadie and Chivenor that did tactical weapons training. And now, due to, I think it was called Options for Change or something, so yet another defence review, they were binning two of them and combining both jobs just at one, and that was going to be Valley. But I was the last ever tactics instructor, last ever TI out of Broadie, which I thought was quite a cool thing to say. So I went there to do my staff training, except I didn't do staff training at Broadie. What you have to do is you have to go through the whole of the TAC weapons course again, a kind of an abridged version, I would say, almost like you're being a student again. It's basically to prove that you can do the trips before you learn how to how to teach the trips. I did that on 79 Squadron at Broadie, and then when I moved up to Valley to start my work up as an instructor, because they closed Broadie shortly after that, I was on 74 Squadron, which, you know, has got a great reputation and a great history as well. So the Hawk Squadron that I joined was just turning into 74 Squadron. 74 Phantoms were the last Phantom Squadron. They kind of they disbanded, and we set up as 74 the very next day with their number.
Was that the J models?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, in fact, no. By that time, they were all FGR2s, I think.
Right.
All that happened was, as the Phantom contracted, it contracted into Wattisham and then contracted into 74 being the last squadron. I think it was all FGR2s by then.
So how do your students feel, you coming from the Phantom? Do they think, oh, he knows it all? You know, were they respectful there?
I tell you what, if they thought I knew it all, then they quickly got disavowed of that. I think, Mike, as I got to be an instructor, the Phantom had just gone out of service and the Buccaneer was going out of service as well. So the ex-Phantom and Buccaneer instructors, it was almost like we had a bit of kudos because the students weren't going to be able to fly those aeroplanes. Whereas for the Tornado F3 and GR instructors that we had, the Jaguar and Harrier instructors, the students were going to fly their aeroplane. And so we were oddities, I suppose. And do you know what? We played up to it as well. We had like a Phantom Mafia on the squadron, and there was a kind of a ground attack Mafia as well, and we bantered each other, and the students saw all of this because we shared a crew room with them, and they got involved in it, and it was all part of, yeah, we learn how to fly these aeroplanes, but we're also learning how to be frontline pilots as well, and that was part of our teaching as well, I think.
Yeah, so like obviously you can't just be a good pilot. Do you have to be good in the crew room, as it were?
Certainly did in my day. You were judged by how good you were in the air, and then how good you were in the bar and the crew room. Now things changed over time, but we were still. I stand to this day. We were still looking at students in the crew room, not making notes in black books or anything, but just saying, you know, is this somebody that I'd like to stand shoulder to shoulder with at the front line? Are they a good egg? And for the students that were really, really good eggs, we'd cut them some slack, because I know that I got some slack cut me in the when I was going through training. I was struggling. Mm-hmm. Maybe people saw something in me that you know, we want at the front line. And that's what I used to look for. And if somebody was struggling and they were a good egg, they became my pet project. And quite a few of us would take on a pet project and try our best to get them through, you know, because they just had some qualities that we wanted.
So how did it work if someone was struggling through flying training and they were a bit arrogant? Did you come across that in your time?
Yeah, with a couple of guys. So we were able to in those days, because we had so many hours available and lots of trips on the course. You could, if you needed to, use one trip just to adjust somebody's attitude. And that certainly happened in my day when I was a student, and we certainly tried it ourselves. I flew with two guys, one who, he had a golden pair of hands. He was probably the best pair of hands of his generation.
Wow.
But he knew it, and he didn't work at it. And his whole demeanor was just wrong. It was so easy for him. I only flew once with him. And I had this thing in my head when I briefed him. God, he was so arrogant, and he was. When we brief, we like to see people who are receptive in briefs. This guy was kind of lolling on the chair like that, and I gave him a little bit of a, you know, are you up for this? You know, do you want to fly this? So, you know, tell your face, you know, that yeah. That you want to do this. Anyway, he rubbed me out the wrong way, and he had a bad reputation on the squadron. Every time we had an authorizers meeting, it would come up about his attitude. So I just thought, God, you know, the first mistake he makes, I'm going to come down on him like a ton of bricks. Mm-hmm. Just show him he's not quite as good as he is. And that's how we used to adjust people's attitudes, if we needed to. It was such a rare occurrence. Anyway, we went flying, and he was awesome. He was awesome in absolutely everything. I'd never been more disappointed in my life. I think at the end of it, no kidding, we were doing a high-level close formation, a trip, which is very difficult handling on the engine and the controls. I'll absolutely guarantee he handled the aeroplane better than I did.
Wow.
The Hawk had two grab handles up here, and we used to pull ourselves around when we were doing air combat. I think two-thirds of the way through the trip, I think I was just hanging on the grab handles like this with my head down, thinking, you know, for God's sake, just let it end. Got back down, and I had to give him a great mark because he was spectacular. But I gave him a little bit of an attitude chat, and had no effect on him whatsoever.
Wow.
And it came to the course was split into two at that point. There was the advanced flying training, old style valley stuff. Mm-hmm. They got their wings, and then they came to us on TAC weapons. And we were all just saying, well, we'll wait until we get him in air combat, and we'll just kick his ass, and maybe that'll humble him a little bit. He never got there. On his final handling test, his wings trip, they set him up with the chief instructor, and chief instructor chopped him on one trip.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that was shocking.
Wow.
But leading up to that, the CI was just sick of getting reports about this guy's attitude. And he was a much more experienced instructor. He was able to put this guy under so much pressure. I think he barely knew his first name when he landed. And it sounds brutal, but that's the kind of guy you can't have at the front line. You know, it's a real band of brothers and sisters at the front line, and anybody who doesn't fit in becomes toxic like that. So, I mean, it sounds brutal, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
I couldn't put him under pressure enough to make him even make a tiny, tiny mistake, but the chief instructor was a lot better at it than I was, I guess.
I've heard like many occasions that you guys like humble on the ground, but you know you're aggressive in the air. Is that true?
Not in the crew room, it's not, and not in the bar. we're humble otherwise. Look, I think the best aviators are the ones that know their limitations. However, if you are teaching air combat or going out to fly air combat, you have to be a slightly different person. We put a different coat on, you know, and we are a little bit arrogant and stuff. If you go into a 1v1 fight against another guy in the same aeroplane, two Hawks, you'll get beaten. That's it. You have to truly believe that you can beat that other person, because if you don't, you're already on the path to losing. So we try. Look, I think I've always been honest about my abilities or lack of. I've always had to work incredibly hard in order to get the success I think that I had. So that's why when I saw a student who was brilliant and wasn't working hard, it used to rub me up the wrong way a little bit. You know, if people have got golden hands, then that's great. I'm very pleased for them. Put the effort in, you'll be a spectacular aviator, you know, if you've got both things going for you.
Good advice there. So let's get into the nitty-gritty. So what kind of flying training would you be conducting?
Right, so let's go back to the early days when I was a TI. Like I said, all I taught was air combat and low level, like the best deal ever. So initially, we'll go out as a singleton on both of those things, where down at low level we teach a guy how to navigate at low level, and it's 420 knots, so it's 7 miles a minute. It's pretty quick down at 250 feet, but they get their teeth into it, and then they start doing it as a pair. And we fly 1 to 2 miles line abreast so that we can check each other's 6 o'clock. Now, just maneuvering a formation like that took an immense amount of brain power. And so one of the first things that we taught was a thing called tactical turning. Now, if I want to turn 10 degrees that way, I'll just turn, and that guy can just kind of motor up a little bit. But if I want to go, say, 60 degrees that way, I can't do that because we'll just end up line astern and I'm not checking his six. So we do this ridiculous dance in the sky, and they're called double-assisted turns. Right, let me see if I can teach you this with the fingers then. So say we want to go 60 left. This guy will go 75 degrees left, and this guy goes 15 degrees right to start with.
Right.
And as we cross over, this guy comes back through 75, this guy comes back through 15. And what we've done is we've maintained the formation integrity as we roll out. It's called a double assisted turn. If we want to go 30 right, this guy turns 30 left. Which just sounds completely odd. This guy goes 60 right, then he reverses through 60, and he reverses through 30, and it miraculously works. Now, now, you know, when you do those for a couple of years, they're just a natural thing for you, and you can do anything between 0 and 90 degrees. You just kind of eyeball it. When you're a student learning that for the first time, the most horrific trick they do is tack formation one, and your brain just ends up like mush. And halfway through the trip, the instructor has to take control for 5 minutes so that you can get your head sorted.
Wow.
And then we drop down and do it at low level, and it just blows people's minds. And it's a steep learning curve, so over time, you just get more and more involved in this. And then, once they've got that sorted, we're doing navigation routes, where the turns aren't called. You just need to know where you are on the route, and you turn and maintain this integrity. And then we add targets into those low-level routes, and that's a progression of the low-level side. On the air combat side, we do a little bit of the weapons instructors do a thing called cine weave, where they get behind an aeroplane does a set maneuver, and they have to get in and out and keep the gun sight on and track. It's a prelude to air combat. Then what we do is we teach them the offensive side of air combat, so they're behind somebody else, and there's various maneuvers that we use to get into a position where we can gun somebody. And then we do the defensive stuff, which isn't quite so pleasant. You're looking over your shoulder at 6G the whole time. And then we do just neutral splits, where we just kind of have at it, and there's a progression, and they get better and better. And then we do two versus one combat, which is, again, it's like a big dance in the sky, yeah, coordinating with another fighter against one bandit. And then once they've got that hacked, we add intercepts to it. So rather than start close together, we start 30, 40 miles apart and do intercepts using kind of mental arithmetic in our brain to build a picture of what's happening. And once we merge with the bandit, then we go into those 2v1 air combat techniques that we've taught them in the previous phase. And so you can see it's quite a big build-up. And all of that, apart from the weapons events, are done with the with the tactics instructor, so that's all I taught. It was, wow. I can't tell you how much fun it was. I mean, it's hard work. You do 3 air combat trips in a day. Ooh. You know, you're on the ragged edge, and you have to brief them and debrief them all correctly as well. So it was hard work. I looked in my logbook not so long ago. There was a period in Valley of 4 months during summer. We used to really maximise summer at Valley. There's a period of 4 months. I think I flew 32 times each month. So I was, by the end of that summer, I was a zombie, I think, yeah.
So what time do these trips start and end? What time do you have to get up, breathe?
So summer, the first trip out in summer, got airborne at 7 o'clock in the morning. That was what we called the weather ship. So we would launch one instructor in an aeroplane, go and check out all the low-level areas, make sure it was fit for solo students. That was a good gig to get on in summer, because you could basically get airborne, put the wheels up and say, you know, well, the weather's fit, you know, because summer was beautiful there. It was pretty hard work in winter. In winter, that got airborne at 7:30 when it was just getting daylight. And then we'd fly 4 waves a day, and on each of those waves, there'd be 8 to 10 aeroplanes, you know, so we were just banging the trips in. And then at various periods, there'd be a night wave as well, because there was night flying on the course.
Would that be the same today, do you think?
Oh, God, no. I mean, they don't have the aeroplanes that we had today. They don't have the number of students going through. And there's plenty of chat about the state of flying training at the moment. It's like a different world, Mike, it really is.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we were a sausage machine, but we were just banging trips out like you read about. We probably flew more trips in 2 or 3 months than they fly in a whole year at Valley.
Wow.
These days.
Big difference.
Yeah, yeah.
So would you mainly fly in Wales, or would you be flying all over the UK?
So the thing about the Hawk is you can get a long way in an hour and 15. So we'd we'd be all through Wales for the low-level areas, maybe punching down into Devon.
Ah.
Those would be the classic areas, yeah, to start with. And then as the trips got more involved, we'd go high level up into Scotland. You get all the way to the north of Scotland,
no way,
fight your way back low level to mid to lower Scotland and then pull out high level back to Valley, across to North Yorkshire, across to East Anglia, if you like. So as the students first started low level, just in Wales, and then we'd branch out into these high-low-high profiles. If we're doing air combat or the intercept stuff, that would generally be in Cardigan Bay, just south of Valley, or we would deploy for a couple of 3 days close to where there was another ground radar site. Like Nita said, we could go across to Wattisham for a couple of days, or Coningsby, or up into Scotland to do that as well. The world was your oyster, really, with a hawk. It could go anywhere. Yeah, it really was. Yeah.
So, could you tell if a student was going to do well?
I think remember the course is split. So, the first bit where it's just pure handling, the QFIs I think could probably tell when somebody was going to do well on the course. Now, you could ace that first part of the course, come to TAC Weapons, and then be hopeless because it was a completely different way of operating, I suppose. It wasn't quite as prescribed as maybe the QFI-ing side of the house. There's a bit more flexibility in it. So you'd get some students who would struggle just flying the aeroplane, would get their teeth into things like air combat because they just loved it. They weren't particularly good at it, but they threw everything into it, and that's all you're looking for. And all we look for really is progression. There are some people who stand out as superstars. That guy I told you about with the golden pair of hands, he might have gotten to TAC Weapons and been hopeless. Who knows? You know, none of us really know when we start off. So it was, you just got to deal with what you've got at the time. And you might have a guy who's doing really well and he just comes up against a roadblock in one particular small bit of the course. Now, when I went through as a student, I was pretty hopeless at ground attack, which is why I went air defence, you know. So I shank phases. I did a lot better in the air combat and air defence phases, I suppose. I said, that's me talking myself up, isn't it, Mike? I was probably less crap in the air defence phases than I was in the ground attack. So you just look for that and you just deal with it at the time. But if they were a good person, a really good guy or girl, you would pull out the stops to get them through that phase, knowing that they might shine in the next one.
So did guys and gals at the time say, like, I want to go into this type, or was it just dependent on their results in the air?
Generally people had an idea at that point what they wanted to fly. Lots and lots of people wanted to fly the Harrier because it was the pinnacle, you know, single seat kind of thing. But we all rail on Harrier pilots for being arrogant and such, but it was a difficult aeroplane to fly. But it was difficult to operate as well. It was very, very intense. And so you could see the people at the start of TAC Weapons who were probably had a chance of making it as opposed to it being a pipe dream. You know, I just want to fly the Harrier. Yeah, you know, we can already tell, mate, that you're not going to be troubling that fleet. But then we're looking for other qualities as well from them. Are they good at interacting with other people? Now, that might send them down a twin seat route, or it might send them to a single seat squadron that's known for being tight knit, and there's all sorts of stuff in it. Now, bearing in mind, we'd all come off those squadrons, so we're probably the best eye to see where they should be going. If somebody really wanted to go somewhere, we'd try our best to help them out to get to that point. If they constantly said, I want to go Jaguar, then all the ex-JAG instructors would take them under their wing and see if that was the deal. If one of them really wanted to go fighter pilot, then the F4 at Mafia would get hold of them, and you know, they'd be our pet project and such. Mostly, if you passed the course to the required standard, you would get what you were asking for. That would be taken into consideration. If you wanted Harrier, then you needed a single seat recommend. If you wanted Jaguar, you needed a single seat recommend. And that was just another little step up that they did. Most guys and girls got to the end of Valley, I would say, capable of going single seat, I would say.
And I have to ask this one, did you have a kind of DACT? Did you ever go up against the Hawk versus Phantom or anything with the students?
Yes, yeah, so not with the students, never with the students.
Right, okay.
But we would do, we quite often do some frontline exercise support, Mike. So I flew against Harriers in a Hawk, Jaguars, Tornado F3. But it wasn't really a, right, we're going out to do some DACT today.
Right.
It was, we were on an exercise and that just happened to be part of that mission.
And did you socialise with the students and did you know when to break away from being a QFI, a social gathering?
So we shared a crew room with the students, which was new for them. Prior to that, they'd always had their own separate crew room. So we shared a crew room with them. That meant, and everything that went with that. So all of the banter was just part of the instruction, a part of growing up as an aviator. The mess life at Valley, I would say for students and instructors alike, was brilliant. Like I said, captive audience. So we'd have big happy hours on Friday where we'd just socialise and banter with the students. The only time that you would ease out would be if somebody had been chopped on a course.
Yeah.
And there's almost like there's an unwritten protocol where if somebody's chopped, and they're a good guy, Mike, all of the instructors will go to the bar that night with that student.
Oh, really?
And commiserate. We'll do that for one or two drinks. And then there's an unwritten protocol that's time for us to leave then, because the students on the course will have a wake. It's almost like a grief cycle. And I've done it myself with guys that have been chopped on courses I've been on. The instructors smooth out and the students then, they can say what they like about us and no doubt they do. And they need to get that stuff out of their system.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who's been chopped, I've always seen it, they always end up in tears. It's horrible. Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely brutal. So that's not time for the instructors to be there.
So in your opinion, what makes a good QFI?
I think instructor as a whole, particularly a QFI who are taking people from scratch and turning them into pilots on that aeroplane, there's a range of things that you need to be. You need to be an instructor, so delivering knowledge and handling training and such like that. You need to be a mentor to them in their whole RAF career type stuff, not just how they are in the air but how they are on the ground as well. You need to be a coach, because if you just direct all the time what they need to do, it's not sustainable. They're not mm-hmm. building their own resilience, so you need to get them to that. You need to be a father figure. You need to be their best friend and you need to be their worst enemy. And there's a whole range of personas that I think the best instructors are able to tap into. I'm not saying I was any good at any of these, but those are the best instructors, I think. Not necessarily, again, the best handling pilots. The best handling pilots don't always make the best instructors. I flew with some instructors myself, and they were Harrier guys, they were gods really, but they couldn't understand that I was crap. I can do this, why can't you do
right.
this? Well, because I'm not very good, that's that's the deal. So I like to think, and I'm sure I fell down a number of times, but I like to think that when I became an instructor, I had a little bit of empathy with the people who did struggle at the start.
And did you ever get, like, let's say you were off the clock and a student said, "Tug, I need to talk." Would you be like, "No, it's not, I can talk," or would you be like, "No, I'm off the clock now"?
No, if anybody ever said they were on or off the clock, then I can't understand that at all. I'll give you an example, Mike. So my second pet project at Valley, he was like the nicest guy who ever went through flying training. I mean, it was just, in the end, it's just not suited to being on a fast jet squadron because, lot of guys we have a touch of the arsehole in us, and he didn't. He was absolutely harmless, lovely guy, always had a smile on his face, failed a lot of trips, but still had a smile on his face. And then he got to my face. As an instructor, you own certain phases of training. You're the one that briefs everybody up before they start the phase. You keep an eye on them as they go through. And my two phases were air combat and air defence, which is the intercepts into 2v1. So he started failing on the 1v1 air combat early doors.
Right.
So I flew with him a couple of times to try and, you know, put my all into giving him the best that we could, because he was such a good good guy. And then he got to the end of the phase, which is five trips, and he'd failed the phase. Now, ordinarily, he'd be up for a chop ride then, and that was that. Now, in those days, we were short of pilots, so there was a little bit of bums on seats type stuff. But also, he was a good guy.
Yeah.
And so we ended up giving him the whole phase again. I don't know how the hell we got away with it. So he got a whole five extra trips. And his problem was not handling. He had a bit of problem putting stuff together. But that's easily sorted out on the ground, talking through planning of sorties and stuff. But the one thing that was almost impossible to fix was he had absolutely no aggression. And when we come to do 1v1, you need to, you know, just bite your lip and get the taste of blood in there sometimes, and get the sight on and pull the trigger. And he could do all the maneuvers to get into position, but he just could, it was like he couldn't take that last step of putting the sight on and squeezing the trigger. And he was in perfect position to do it. Sounds like a Top Gun film, doesn't it? You know, put the sight on, Mav, and such. But but that was it. He was that archetypal guy. I tried everything to turn him into an aggressive little bugger, you know. And no matter what I did, I used to brief this poor guy to death. And then I started doing a kind of tough love thing with him.
Right.
And then he was up for his chop ride on the Monday morning. And I got him to come round to my quarter on Sunday morning. And I gave him even more training on Sunday morning in my house. So there was no on the clock, off the clock. I'm not saying this to say, hey, look how dedicated I was. Every instructor would have done exactly the same thing.
Right.
And I had him round on Sunday, and I was doing his chop ride, and had him round on Sunday, tried to get him aggressive, and it just didn't work. And on the Monday, I chopped him, and it killed me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if he wasn't a good guy, Mike, I'd have slept soundly after that, and it wouldn't have been a drama. He was such a nice guy. And I'd taken him on as my pet project, and that was a massive failure on my part as well. So I just felt so bad for him. He ended up flying multi-engine aeroplanes all over the world at a ball, apparently, probably flying for an airline now, you know. And so he did have a good time. Perhaps he was just not the right fit for that environment. So yeah, great shame though. Great guy.